We're going to officially call the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee to order. We don't yet have a quorum. Members, we're going to take up the items on the agenda, but we will recess and reconvene at 6:30. Actually, it'll be immediately following session in room 400 North to take up just House File 863. We've already heard all of the testimony on that bill. We'll get it in our possession on the House floor today. We need to pass it out so it can make deadline and make it to the next committee. So with that, Representative Allen, we're going to have you start. We don't yet have a quorum, but when we do get a quorum, I will be moving that House File 1187 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. So Representative Allen, members, I just want you to know that this bill actually exists in another place as well, and they've just kind of spun off the provisions that we needed to hear for our purposes so that we could make certain that we heard these important provisions. So, Representative Allen, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Susan Allen, presenting House File 1187. And do we have no amendments? And this, as the Chair mentioned, this was taken out of the House File 485, and this is Article 2. And we have testifiers here. I'll just give you a brief background. As you know, the Safe Harbor Act, the Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth Act of 2011 changed Minnesota's approach to meeting the needs of sexually exploited children. Safe Harbor defined prostituted children as the victims of sexual exploitation, ended reliance upon delinquency proceedings as the sole system's response to meeting the needs of these crime victims, and called for creation of a framework for implementation of these changes, which will become effective August 1st, 2014, and that's what House File 8485 is about. And there is a problem that was not addressed in the Safe Harbor 2011, in that it failed to protect all sexually exploited children from being adjudicated delinquent for being commercially sexually exploited, and it conflicts with Minnesota's trafficking laws, which we'll talk more about. While Minnesota treats the prostitution of 16 and 17-year-olds as a serious felony, it continues to treat the victims of that crime as delinquents. Only young children, those under 16, are excluded from the delinquency definition under the Safe Harbor Act. Sexually exploited 16 and 17-year-olds can still be adjudicated delinquent for being trafficked, and that's what we're here today to present. Testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michelle Garnett McKenzie. I am the Director of Advocacy at the Advocates for Human Rights. I'll just walk briefly through the bill, and then we have County Attorney Backstrom and some of our police officers with us, as well as Ms. Beasley from Breaking Free, just to give the committee a brief picture of the issue. We've asked everyone to move things along quickly for you.
Absolutely. So if you could just tell us what the bill does and then specifically focus on some of the issues that are within the jurisdiction of this committee.
Yes.
Go ahead.
This entire bill isn't within the jurisdiction of this committee. This, as Representative Allen said, does complete the work that was begun in 2011, making sure that all sexually exploited children are not treated as the perpetrators of crimes, but rather are treated as the victims of either sex trafficking or of prostitution of a minor, both of which are felonies. This committee has the opportunity to really make laws come in line with a victim-centered approach that builds strong prosecutions of the bad people working on prostitution, the traffickers, and those who buy sex from minors, while getting the kids the appropriate treatment and getting them out of the system of prostitution and the life in which they can be exploited and coerced and continue to be abused. This act would remove all prostituted children under 18 from delinquency. It's a very simple change that was considered in 2011. And it would repeal a diversion program that was set up in 2011 that works within the criminal justice system rather than this approach of a victim-centered, non-criminal approach. Now that we have evidence-based models that will meet the victim's needs, we are equipped to really work with 16 and 17-year-olds who are victims of sexual exploitation as crime victims. As the committee knows and is well aware, it's a felony in Minnesota to traffic children for sex. It is a felony to engage in prostitution of a child under 18. Prostituted kids should be treated as crime victims, and this bill would just do the work of recognizing them all as such and allow our prosecution and police to address the problem in that manner. I turn things over to County Attorney Backstrom at this point.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. I am pleased to be here today to strongly support this legislation. I am proud to be part of a coalition of prosecutors in the metro area here in the Twin Cities under the leadership of Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, who stepped up on this issue even before your 2011 legislation was passed in connection with trying to protect the juvenile victims of prostitution and sex trafficking. We, by policy, accomplished what you established by law later that year, and we also support establishing that same policy for 16 and 17-year-old young women who are forced into a lifestyle that is harmful, obviously, to them and to our society as a whole. Now, sex trafficking, as John Choi said yesterday before many of you in another committee, is one of the greatest human rights atrocities in our society today. We need to work together to put a stop to it. We need to protect the victims, the youthful victims of these offenses, in any way we can, and we can do that through our child protection system for any youth under the age of 18, and we need to do that. So by doing that, by having a victim-centered approach, as this bill will complete, we can be more effective in our ability to prosecute the true offenders, the sex traffickers who are dangerous, unscrupulous criminals that need to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And I can pledge to you that Minnesota County attorneys are dedicated to do just that. So our strong support is with this bill. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Representative Allen, any other testifiers?
Yes, we do.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is John Bandemer. I'm a sergeant with the St. Paul Police Department. I'm also director of the Gerald Vick Human Trafficking Task Force, which is a task force of law enforcement officers and prosecutors working together with service providers to investigate human trafficking crimes and provide services to those victims that we identify. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that law enforcement and the people that work within this area of investigating sex trafficking crimes are kind of a tight community. We work these cases collaboratively together in the metro area and are trying to branch out into the outstate regions. And what we're finding is that there's some confusion as to who a victim is. We teach a victim-centered approach to investigating these crimes. And a victim means anybody under the age of 18 in that approach. And that is, it's a nationwide approach that we're trying to adopt within the state of Minnesota, our law enforcement community. It's important for us to focus on the fact that the real bad guys out there are the traffickers, the predators of these young girls who are always on the lookout for another young girl to corrupt and to victimize and using them to profit. So in our investigations, we use the ability to gain confidence of our young victims and the trust of our young victims to be able to investigate against the traffickers who really should be the ones that we're investigating. And having a confusion of whether or not they are a victim or they are have committed a crime is something we always have to get over first. And I would ask that the committee pass this amendment and assist us in law enforcement in providing services for these young girls the way they should be, as victims of crime, and not be treated as offenders, so that they feel more openly to cooperate with us in investigating and prosecuting the traffickers.
Thank you. Representative Allen, any other testifiers?
Madam Chair, we have one to give a brief statement.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sergeant Grant Snyder. I'm the lead investigator on all sex trafficking cases with Minneapolis Police. And like my colleague, Sergeant Bandemer, just said, and we have worked collaboratively with his group and with other agencies around the around the state as well as around the country. When I've done training with many of these organizations, that is a big issue as to how we identify these victims and how we relate to them. One of the things that I've really found in doing these cases for some time now is that, you know, doing a sex trafficking investigation and working with the victim is really about removing barriers. And that those barriers sometimes are barriers within the child's life. They're barriers within our own biases toward the victims. And sometimes they're barriers that exist within the law itself. I can tell you from personal experience in dealing with these children victims that that threat of possible adjudication presents a great issue for us in attempting to gain their cooperation and build rapport with those children. Case in point is a recent rescue that we did back last year with a young woman who had been trafficked not once but five times over a period of a couple of months. And she repeatedly, after we rescued her and would place her someplace, was being pulled out of those placements by the traffickers themselves, being sold again, and found herself once again in a situation where she was a victim of trafficking. Per the letter of the law, she could have been charged for those subsequent events. But I will tell you that it is part of the best practices that myself and I know Sergeant Bandemer's approach to this has always been to prevent that adjudication. We in practice don't charge those children and those victims with those cases because we recognize that the process toward their recovery will oftentimes span several months and oftentimes span several rescues. I wish I could say that it weren't so, that we always get them the first time, but it simply isn't that. So we need the assistance of this law to be able to honestly tell that child that they're not doing anything wrong, they haven't done anything wrong, and that we're there to view them not only as a victim and survivor, but also as a partner in that prosecution. Thank you.
Representative Allen.
Madam Chair, we have one last testifier who would like to give a prepared statement, Nikki Beasley.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam. My name is Nikki Beasley. I am the Director of Programs at Breaking Free right here in St. Paul, Minnesota. Victims of human trafficking are especially vulnerable to the debilitating physical and psychological symptoms of trauma resulting from their repeated, intrusive, and long-term abuse. Providers like myself working with this population emphasize that trauma recovery is critical to a victim's ability to repair and regain his or her life. Minor victims of sex trafficking are frequently in need of services that may include out-of-home placement. We as providers are advocating for residential facilities in which these children can receive support, comprehensive services, and a start on the path to recovery. We recognize that these minors meet the statutory definition of a minor victim of sex trafficking and therefore deserve the humanitarian protections called for under the law. Specialized and intensive care is needed to ensure long-term stability and exit out of the life. We know that these programs need to be safe, trauma-informed, population-specific, and adequately funded. Furthermore, programs currently housing sex trafficked victims, such as runaway and homeless youth shelters and group homes, need additional training and access to appropriate resources to better serve this population. The future safety and stability of this vulnerable population of victims rests on our ability to provide a safe space in which they can recover from the trauma of their trafficking situation and be given a chance at a new life free from exploitation. Thank you.
Questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know who this would go to. Any of you could probably answer this, but I'm assuming that young boys are caught into this too, but is it just so much more that it's the girls? Could you speak to that a little bit?
Could you repeat your last name? I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Sergeant Snyder.
Snyder?
Thank you. Snyder, yes.
Okay.
I won't speak for my colleague, Sergeant Bandemer, but we've had the opportunity to investigate two cases involving males in the last year. We know they're out there. There are some fairly significant barriers in detection. In both of those cases, one of those cases, we were not able to prove the trafficking, but we were able to recommend services. In the other one, this was a young 17-year-old male who was working off Backpage, and so we were able to do some work with that individual, and we have ongoing contact with him. There is a much higher volume, based on what I know, of young women, just for the very issue of demand. But the men are out there, and we need to get better at how we detect them and how we provide services to them.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, these kids who engage in this behavior, are they aware that it's wrong before they, they've got to know that they're committing something that's morally and very likely legally wrong. Do they not?
Sergeant Bandimer.
Bandimer?
Police. Yes. The best answer I can give for that is I think that the victims that we encounter in these investigations, by virtue of being under the age of 18, by also virtue of always seems like have other issues in their life, whether it be socioeconomic or developmental issues, have a hard time making that distinction. They have other problems that they have, to include other behavioral issues, which make them the vulnerable population that they are for the traffickers. It is what the traffickers often prey upon. So I think that it's difficult, and we would investigate it as if a child under the age of 18 cannot make that decision on their own. That's why we treat them as victims. And they can't decide on their own that they're going to be involved in life of prostitution.
Representative Drazkowski.
May I also answer that? Is that okay, madam?
What was your last name again?
Beasley.
Ms. Beasley.
I just wanted to address that same question. What we also see is that there's so much coercion and brainwashing that happens, and grooming, quite frankly, that happens with young girls and boys, and that even if there's a feeling that it's not okay, they also feel like the alternative to maybe reaching out and getting safe is more harmful to them. And so there is that conflict of this doesn't feel right, this isn't right, but the alternative is possibly detrimental to myself or my family.
Representative Drazkowski.
So, I'm having a hard time understanding here, Madam Chair, but when you apprehend these people, do they come to law enforcement or do they try to elude you?
Mr. Bandimer,
yes. Generally, they don't come to law enforcement to seek assistance. It's usually we're finding them through other sources. Other people are reporting their activity. Other people are reporting their victimization, whether it's family members, school members, people within the community corrections with the county systems, will report these as tips and say, I think this person is a victim of child prostitution. Those are generally how we get the tips and lead to our investigations, and we try to encounter these young girls any way we can, whether or not it's just finding them at school or at a shelter or someplace where we can get a face-to-face to talk to them and start gaining that rapport with them. As Sergeant Snyder reported, it's about getting the rapport, making them understand what's happening to them, it's not okay, and that they don't have to do this. But as Nikki said, they don't have those other options. They don't know what those options are, and they need somebody to tell them.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I struggle, and I guess I'm not getting the answers really directly here, but I struggle to understand exactly how they are forced into this. And I understand some people are predisposed because of socioeconomic situations and mental health issues and others to things maybe people who weren't predisposed to those might be. And then I wonder, are they all forced into this? How are they forced into it, and are they all forced into it? That would be the question.
Mr. Bandimer.
Actually, Sergeant Snyder, Madam Chair.
Sergeant Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, when we rescue a victim, when we identify a victim, which is what the majority of our time is really spent doing, probably about 60-70%, is about identifying and rescuing victims. That's really our primary focus. There are people within that scope, within the group of people we would consider to be victims, whose actions would on the outside appear that they're not victims because they've, gone willingly into a hotel room or something like that. When you peel back the experiences, and they're quite eloquent at expressing what they've been through, a whole different spectrum of coercion and force and things like that starts to unfold for us. Imagine, if you will, being a 15-year-old girl on the streets of North Minneapolis, and you're miles from anybody that you know, miles from home, and you're a runaway. You put yourself there. You got off the bus, and you're 26th and Emerson. That is an inherently coercive situation. Your only currency at that point is your body. You have nothing in your pocket. You have no way to eat, no place to sleep, nothing like that. When we talk to the girls, they understand their role in this process. They can comprehend that things that they've done brought them to that point. And that's the very reason that they accept too much responsibility for this. Regardless of whether as a child you've made bad choices like running away or going to a party and drinking, you never deserve to be sexually exploited. There is always a trafficker in that relationship, whether that trafficker is a person that put their picture on Backpage, or it's a person that answered a Backpage ad and came to the room and is willing to pay to have sex with a child. There's always a perpetrator there. There's always somebody that's victimizing them. That's my personal perspective.
Representative Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative. And this is about commercial sexual exploitation. It is a huge profit-making endeavor. And the average child that is sexually exploited happens, the average age is 12 to 14 years old. That's 6th and 7th grade. And you can't tell me that is something that is consensual, and that and the life in that being sexually exploited, doesn't matter if you're 16, 17 years old. You can't consent to being basically sometimes raped or exploited, and that they're vulnerable. They are children in need of protection, and it's a whole different way of looking at prostitution, and it's something that this model addresses.
Other questions from members? Representative Droskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I still struggle. I mean, we have deterrence in place right now. I'm trying to remember exactly what the consequences are for these young folks that find themselves in this situation. Again, I understand those influences, and I sometimes wonder in a broader scope of what we do here, and this bill happens to be an example of it. When we continue to remove consequences for youth and their behavior, and I think there's a coddling culture that we as adults and in our Minnesota culture especially like to create a victim mentalities for people. And with this whole idea, and I've heard victims before people even have been proven to be victims, I mean, before they've even been apprehended, to realize if they have or have not been victims. We like to label people that before we get there. And that's what our culture does. And law enforcement does it a lot. And I understand the propensity to do that. I get that. But the effect of that and what that does, I heard the word vulnerable. And, I just wonder if we are making youth weaker or stronger by creating these labels for them and putting them in a situation or characterizing them as a group of people who are suddenly victims and they're weaker don't instead instill or at least maintain the levels of deterrence that we have in the law now to give them the ability to accept some responsibility and to become instead stronger rather than what appears to me to be an influence that encourages them to think they're weaker. Just a statement, Madam Chair. Thank you.
I just want to see, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Representative Lesh, Representative Allen, did you want to respond to that? Or
I'll defer to
Mr. Snyder.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative, I appreciate that comment so significantly, because that really is the elephant in the room. Now, I can tell you from my perspective as a sergeant, as a detective, as a police officer, and I won't speak for Sergeant Bandimer, but I think you would feel the same way, that the idea that we would back decriminalizing anything it requires a fairly significant ideological shift. I'm not in favor of it. Originally, I was not in favor of it, and I understand the struggles that are associated with that. My personal perspective is that this is such a unique population. I mean, think about the way in which we treat a single sex trafficking victim with a single, I'm sorry, single sex assault victim with a single event of victimization, one. And we acknowledge, as a community, as a society, as institutionally, we acknowledge the trauma and the services and everything that goes along with that one incident of sexual assault. Now take that and multiply that exponentially by 10, by 20, by 30, sometimes 40 or 50 different assaults, different events of trauma that are encapsulated in this young life. That's a victim to me. And I accept and understand the complication with making that shift because I had to go through it myself. There's so many things wrong in that event and in that incident with that child and in that whole experience of sex trafficking that can't be handled with a delinquency proceeding or can't be handled correctionally. And that's from my perspective in dealing with these children, that's what I see.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look around the table of those of us who are charged with making policy on this bill, and I see people that have advanced degrees. Most people are in the top 30%, maybe 20% of income earners, sometimes even higher. Most of us have had supportive parents as we grew up, and I see how nearly impossible it is to walk a mile in the shoes of an individual that you just described, Sergeant Snyder. Almost impossible. Now, I'm a prosecutor, so I see it more often than most. County Attorney Backstrom is a prosecutor, and I see about 90% of the people I see that come through the courtroom I am there just because of bad decisions. Now, there might be 5 to 10% that are bad people, and we're focusing on a different population of who can be redeemable, who can we save, who can we pull out of this. But in order to do that, you need to reach past the threshold that you just described and say, wow, why is it? Are we just coddling these people? And I look at the population of folks that I've served in the courtroom. Some of them, maybe they are coddled. But the vast majority of the folks you need to focus on are the people that are salvageable, the people that are redeemable. And so I appreciate you trying to educate those of us who have no idea, no sense of what it's like when you've been beaten down day after day, week after week. How many days does it take? How many years does it take to recover from a year where you've been treated the way that you have some of the people in the population you deal with? And maybe you're 3 years out of the trauma, and you can say, well, you know what? I'm going to provide you this hook. Here are your bootstraps. Just reach down and grab them. Pull yourself up. Take some responsibility. Well, they're not at the threshold yet. People in my courtroom, they're not at the threshold yet. They're not at the place where they can actually do that. So you have to say, give them another chance and yet another chance. So thanks for doing what you're doing. It's very difficult for us to understand the predicament that the folks you serve find themselves in, but the only way we can get there is by trying year after year. And thank you, County Attorney Backstrom, for being in this place where you can educate us as well, because some of us find it difficult.
With that, the chair
removed. Can I say just one other thing, Madam Chair?
Ms. Beasley.
I just wanted to address the stronger, weaker spectrum that you were speaking about. These kids, we view them as very strong. And I believe that children, there is a level of coddling that they deserve because they're children. And for any of the victims that we've worked with, and when we discuss the Safe Harbor Bill and the no wrong door model, they all say if this were in place for our older victims, if this were in place when they were children, this could have saved them. This law could have saved them. This model could have saved them. And so I just wanted to really speak on behalf of youth that they are strong, regardless of the situations that they go through.
With that, the chair renews her motion that House File 1187 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Allen. Representative Druskowski, do you want to connect? So members, while Representative Druskowski comes to the table, I want to let you know that we've learned that tomorrow we're going to be recessing and then coming back onto the floor at 6 o'clock. So while we originally posted our meeting for 6, now that we'll be going back on the House floor, We're actually thinking that we should move our meeting up so that we aren't here late into the evening. So we've been told that 3:30 would be available to us. So if there's no objection of members of the committee of me moving up the committee meeting till 3:30 tomorrow instead of after session, this would be tomorrow. If there's no objection to that, I'd like to do that instead of meeting into whatever hours of the night tomorrow night. Questions from members? All right. We also will be adding a bill. Representative Simon has a bill that I think is non-controversial that we've spoken with Representative Groskowski about that we'll be adding to the agenda. But the 24-hour amendment rule is waived for that meeting just because of the timing of the meeting and bills being added. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have a room number for that meeting tomorrow?
Should be room 10. If it changes, you'll get an email from staff. All right. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you say 3:30? So
yes,
session's going to be short then tomorrow as well. Okay.
So we'll go into session early. It'll be short, and then we'll be recessing and coming back into the evening for session. So rather than waiting till after the second session, we thought we should meet between those sessions. Does that work? Any objection to that? All right. Representative Groskowski, please go ahead and describe your bill. Members, we'll be laying this bill over for possible inclusion. So, Representative Groskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 974 is a bill. It's you can read it. It's a simple bill. It would simply provide flexibility for local county law libraries and their law library boards and the county boards the flexibility, if they would like to use some of the dollars in their law library fund, to use them for the local technology costs that we've heard from the courts about the need for the counties to be able to come up with some source of funding to provide for their broadband, wireless, etc. And I've come to, I actually represent Paymar in a past life when we were in the minority last time and he was chair of, I don't remember the committee, it was Public Safety and Judiciary then, I think, Representative Paymar. And we were looking actually at drug courts then and maybe freeing this up for that at that time. But this is simply a permissive bill that gives the local unit of government the flexibility, additional flexibility. Anyway, that's the bill.
Representative Groskowski, any testifiers? We do have some people that signed up to testify in opposition to your bill.
Oh, I don't have any, Madam Chair.
Okay. Anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill, please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Hello, my name is Brenda Wolf, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Coalition of County Law Libraries, and I'd like to read a statement on behalf of our organization. The mission of our organization is to provide a forum for policy discussion, information exchange, county law library improvement and mentorship, professional development, and to assist and act as an advisory body to the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Minnesota Judicial Council, Judicial Administration Directors, the State Court Administrator, and County Court Administrators. As president of the Minnesota Coalition of County Law Libraries, I'm here to voice our concerns regarding the proposed bill, House File Number 974, which authorizes the use of our county law library fees for enhancements to state court technology. County law libraries are solely funded by a designated fee included in civil and criminal matters. The amounts collected and spent vary from county to county. Independent law library boards in each county govern the operation of that county's law library. The Minnesota Coalition of County Law Libraries objects to proposed changes to the current statutes, Minnesota Statute Section 134A12 and 134A13, enabling law library fees to be used by the state courts for technology systems and infrastructure, and enabling the county board to disperse law library funds at the direction of the county board for the following reasons. The first is, historically, from 1949 forward, the legislature created specific county law library statutes to ensure the county law library designated funds are properly expended and assigned. That fiduciary duty is to the independent county law library boards of trustees. Pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 134A13, the Board of Trustees is empowered to use law library funds to maintain the law library in accordance with its bylaws. Besides purchasing books and electronic resources, any use of the funds that would increase effective use of the library, enhance resource sharing, and support the library mission is proper. County law libraries are not governed or controlled by the judicial branch or the county board. County law libraries are separate entities created by statute, governed by independent county law library boards. Therefore, dispersal of funds cannot and should not be directed by the county board as proposed in House File Number 974. County law library funding is not derived from state taxes. By statute, a law library fee is designated for the law library and collected in civil matters and may be imposed in criminal matters. The amount of these fees is determined in each county by the county law library board and approved by the county board. Pursuant to Minnesota Statute Section 134A12, these collected fees are allotted solely for the support of the library. The entire revenue source of a county law library is from the fees designated and collected in this manner. In most metro area county law libraries and across our state, our current operational expenses are exceeding our revenues and reserve funds are being depleted to ensure adequate service levels. Unlike the county law library funding, judicial branch funding is a statewide responsibility. Not only is usage of a portion of the law library fees not a tenable or sustainable solution to financial issues the judiciary is encountering for technology systems and infrastructure, it would also greatly diminish the availability of resources and staff to assist the public currently accessible at the county law libraries and consequently decrease the support of our mutual mission of access to justice for all. Minnesota County Law Libraries remain a gateway for equal justice by free and open availability of materials and resources to the public and to legal professionals. Open and free access is the essence of a democratic society. Fostering a relationship of ongoing cooperation with the court system, the services and materials offered by the county law libraries take a significant burden off the courts and speed and improve the access to justice for citizens. Public access to county law libraries where free court forms are available, free legal advice and information clinics are offered, court procedures are explained, and research materials provided improves citizens' trust in the fairness and purpose of the court system. The Minnesota Coalition of County Law Libraries is committed to maintaining a strong county law library system in Minnesota and continuing our individual county law library programs and services for the public. We request that the committee vote against any changes in our current system of funding and governance. If the committee needs any further information regarding our position or information about county law library services or the role we play in the justice system, please do not hesitate to contact us. I also have our position in a handout, if I can give it to the page to distribute and make copies for everyone. We also have some other county law librarians here who would like to address the committee.
Absolutely. Please state your name for the record. Just try not to repeat the testimony that's already been given.
Of course. Thank you. My name is Brian Huffman. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. I'm a county law librarian, have been so for about 5 years through two different county libraries. Before that, I practiced law for over a decade. I serve as vice president to the Minnesota Association of Law Libraries, which is a local chapter of the American Association of Law Libraries. I know some of you are lawyers, businessmen and women, teachers, and members of law enforcement. I know you recognize the importance of libraries and the service we perform for the public. I'm here today to share with you the services we provide and a rationale for opposing this legislation. The mission of my law library is to provide adequate and timely legal information to the judiciary, government employees, the members of the bar, and the citizens of Dakota County. In the form most comprehensible to all types of users, bearing in mind that ready and convenient access to such information is vital to the system of justice in a democratic society, We also collaborate with existing organizations to maximize the delivery of legal information and to avoid costly and ineffective duplication. Our last point is to utilize information technology to deliver legal information wherever financially feasible and acceptable to users. At my law library, we assisted over 6,200 at both our locations last year. We do this in an ever-challenging economic situation. Our revenues have declined about 10% per year in the recent years, while our cost of books and online databases increased 5 to 8%. My law library partners with legal assistance and the court provide 6 legal clinics per month in 3 locations. We have 34 volunteer attorneys who meet with members of the public to assist them with their legal concerns. In 2012, the Self-Help Center assisted over 500 individuals. House File 974 calls for using law library fees for enhancements to state technology. Law libraries already do this. As at the law library where I work, we were the first to bring public wireless access to the Judicial Center. We are the only location where members of the public may access the internet, conduct online case law research through Westlaw and Lexis, and complete document assembly of certain court forms, like divorce, etc. Many court law libraries are partnering with the judicial branch already on e-filing initiatives. A fault of this bill is the lack of recognition of separation of powers. County law libraries are not under the judiciary. We are county entities with our own statutory authority and governance by board of trustees. Our funding comes from the fees paid by those who use the courts and by those who are assessed criminal fines. It would be inappropriate to allot our funds for any purposes other than the support of the county law library. In conclusion, I hope my testimony has afforded you some insight into the services we provide and the need to safeguard our institutions. Our programs need to stay strong and well-funded. I ask for you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and try not to repeat any of the testimony that you've already heard.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Judy Flater. I'm the Olmsted County Law Librarian. I am here today, I'm sorry, to oppose this bill for many of the reasons that the other county law librarians have mentioned. And you actually do have in the packet I sent out to you, there is a short executive summary, and then there is a longer detailed analysis of the issues. Just a brief summary of the issues. County law libraries are a unique creature, statutorily designated. In the sense that we are independent. We are independent of the courts, and we are also independent of our counties, although title to our libraries is held in our counties. So we're not under the judiciary, but we're not actually under the counties either. And if you look at the statutory designation, you'll find that county law libraries follow public libraries, 134 to 134A. The counties are in the 300s, I believe, and the judiciary is in the 480s. So if you look at where we fit statutorily, we're nowhere near either the counties or the courts. Our funds are derived strictly from court fees, fees and fines, and they come to us, through the administrative purposes of the courts and go into a dedicated fund. The County Law Library Board is actually statutorily designated as well and is not under the authority of the county. So it is an independent board. This unique position allows county law libraries to be neutral in regard to their place in the court process and legal information purveyors. And that's a very important position for us to maintain. We set our fees so that they will maintain the operations of the law library, and many of those have been designated already. Types of things that we do, all of the things that they've talked about being done in other counties, we do in Olmsted County as well. We are also partnering now or working on a partnership with Winona County Law Library, which is another county law library in our district, to do some collaboration there so that we can extend services to the public even further and make the best use we can of the funds that come to us. But as noted, we set our fees to support the libraries. There really isn't anything extra there. So we would not particularly want our fees going to another purpose. I think it's a very dangerous precedent to set that that law library funds would be allotted to something other than the support of county law libraries. and it is critical that the Law Library Board, who has the fiduciary responsibility under statute, not have to share that. So I think that's me for now.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and go ahead and try not to duplicate any of the testimony that we've heard.
I'm Janet Kruger. I am a public defender in the 3rd District. I'm also a trustee on the Olmsted County Law Library Board. And I wanted to give you the viewpoint from somebody who's not trying to protect their job. I'm not a librarian. But that law library is very critical to many of my clients. As a public defender, all I can do for my clients is represent them on their criminal matters. Most people with limited incomes have other issues that they have a need to bring into the court, and those people could not have their matters heard if it wasn't for the law library being there with clinics and other forms of help for them. We refer people to the law library on a daily basis. We have seen the patrons coming to the Olmsted County Library steadily increasing as the economy has been in a downturn. People need it more and more, and we just think it's totally inappropriate to think about reducing those services or trying to take any of that revenue stream, which is specifically for the law libraries, and trying to divert it into other places.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any further testimony? Please come to the table, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Mary Freiberg. I'm the Scott County Law Librarian. We have one of the smallest square footage law libraries in the state of Minnesota, yet we have seen 26,000 people in the last 2 years. We're one of the busiest law libraries in the state of Minnesota. And I basically just want to say what jeopardizes law libraries. Funding jeopardizes law libraries. And it's just common sense to me, if you're going to affect the funding, you're going to affect the quality and the performances and the services that we will be able to offer to the people in our area. I'm hoping that you received, I've brought a letter from me personally, and I'm hoping you all received an email from Judge Rex Stacy, who is the president of the Scott County Law Library Board, who also wanted me to let you know he is not in favor of changing the statute.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you. Well, this language is not a must, it's a may. It's leaving it up to the discretion. And I guess my question would go to Representative Joskowski. Are there some law libraries around that have large balances that the money's just sitting there being unused? Is that the reason for bringing the bill?
Representative Joskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Scott, actually, my understanding of the ability to consider law library funds and fee, their funds for things like this happened a few years ago when I learned that one, for sure, maybe two of the law libraries in my district at the time had surplus balances. And so the county boards in those counties were actually saying, you know, there's some dollars there that could be used for something else, you know, that aligns with the courts. And so, they're within the last 4 years, there definitely have been counties with surpluses. I haven't inventoried them, but I don't know how prevalent that is either.
Any further questions from members? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Draskowski, I haven't known too many more stoic people than librarians, and law librarians more so than most, and you managed to stir up a hornet's nest. So congratulations. But it causes me to wonder, it appears to me that if they've had surpluses, that they've been fiscally prudent, and why you would have a bill that would seek to punish that, I don't understand.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lesh, thank you. The idea here was, Representative Lesh, rather than there are additional technology needs that have been identified, and rather than putting further burdens on the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota, it makes a lot of sense to use existing funds that have already been collected from them in order to pay for those. Thank you.
Well, members, I think I should probably let you know that I spoke to Representative Druskowski about introducing a fee bill to fund technology. We talked about this, and I think he'd rather that we not do my bill. And so he was looking for additional revenue to fund the technology I want to pay for. And so I appreciate your creativity. We're going to hear my bill next, though. So with that, the chair lays over House File 974. Thank you, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 1398 for possible inclusion in the judiciary funding bill, and it'll be laid over as well.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom moves House File 1398 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, we've all been hearing that the court is moving towards implementation of e-discovery and e-filings. And I believe that one of the things we need to consider as a legislative body is the people who have to work with those e-filings and e-discovery and technology. We've heard over and over again the testimony that there are more pro se defendants, there are more pro se litigants in family court, and the more we move towards technology in the court, the more important having equal access to the courts and this technology available. So members, I'm actually looking at and asking that you consider as we move forward actually creating a technology fund, and we should have some discussion about who should be on the group that makes the decision about how that technology money is spent. But as the court uses their budget to implement technology in the courtroom, I think we have an obligation to make certain that other organizations, the public defenders and pro se defendants, also have access to technology. Right now, I don't have a technology dollar amount, but just as the law library fee can be up to $10 for the law library fee, I believe I'm hoping that we can come to a dollar amount that will actually meet some of the technology needs statewide. And with that, Madam Chair, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Are there questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to be heard on the bill? With that, then we lay House File 1398 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, the next item that I'd like to take is House File 1396. Members, this might be slightly controversial, so I just want to let you all know that this is an issue that was brought to my attention, and it was brought to my attention by the school bus operators, and this is one solution that we came up with after some discussion, but it's certainly not the only solution that's available. So what House File 1396 does is it attempts to address the issue that was brought to my attention that when people drive through the school bus stop arm, there is a mandatory court appearance, and what's happening is that folks are not getting these convictions on their records, and the school bus drivers are concerned about that. And so with me are the school bus drivers, and I'd like them to kind of talk you through the issue they identified.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, and this is one of the issues that we sort of heard first about from the State Patrol, where the two main stories that I think are the most illustrating of the issue is that, as Representative Hillstrom said, that there were two particular stop arm violations that the State Patrol told us about at a convention, and I've been using them as I talk to members in regards to what we're trying to stop. One particular instance, a driver passed a school bus with the flashing red lights out, the stop arm out, but the person was on the sidewalk where the kids were walking off the school bus. The other is a state trooper was in a fully marked Suburban with state patrol lights and all that, stopped behind a school bus, and a person decided to pass the state patrol officer's Suburban and the school bus while the stop arm and the flashing red lights were on. Where this all sort of started in the fast version is there's this handout in your packet, and what we're describing is the four yellow buses, which are categorized as type A, B, C, and D. That sort of gives you an example of what we're talking about. The main trigger point, I think, is the second letter on the second page in that was dated January 28th, 2003, which is a continuation of a national school bus illegal passing survey. And if you go further into the documents, I marked them up in the corner. Page 5 is the colored one. Looks like that. I'm sorry, but in your cases, it's black and white. So,
Madam Chair?
Does not everyone have it? Representative Drazkowski.
At least two of us don't have it. Representative Johnson and I don't.
Representative Kamer didn't have one either. I gave him my copy.
I have one here.
I apologize to that member. Mr. Kelleher?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, your version is not color. I should say it's black and white and would just look like the horizontal with the lines and the states down the left. The last page, second to last page, mark number 5.
I think everyone has it now, Mr.
Okay,
Kelleher.
Good. Madam Chair, just to continue real fast, the stop arm survey for violations on one day in 2011, if you go down to Minnesota, which is about two-thirds down the list, Lieutenant Ari Carroll was the previous lieutenant for the Office of Pupil Transportation Safety. Our school buses, our contractors participated in the survey. We had about 2,500 buses participating in the survey. We had 337 passing incidents marked in that one day. And then if you see the next number over, it's actually 529 because some people freight train through. First person goes, second person follows them through as well. So that's why that number is a little larger. And if you, we have requested it, through, and we're participating with the State Patrol to go ahead and do this survey again. We just felt that when the State Patrol inquired about how many convictions and how many moving violations were charged with this particular fine, which is 169.444, I believe, if I'm 169.444 subdivision 2, we found that there were only about 200 or 300 convictions for an entire year. So somebody in the system was waiving these moving violations or reducing the fines or reducing the moving violation to some activity that was less than a moving violation. What we ultimately wanted to have happen was something a little more glamorous, something that would get in the newspaper that would show that the school bus operators are very serious about school bus safety, and we'd like to alert the public that this is something that's going on, it's wrong, and it shouldn't occur. When we met with Representative Hillstrom and the police chiefs and some others, we thought maybe the fastest, most expedient solution was to put it on the payable list. That since we were seemed to be finding out that through the statistics, through the court systems, and to the State Patrol information that they found out, we were missing thousands and thousands of people who were charged with this violation and that had their fines reduced and or their moving violation reduced. If any of you have ever been to court and told the judge that you'll not do the same or similar crime for 90 days, I think Representative Latz probably has some experience with this in his profession. And the fines get, I mean, Lesh, I'm sorry, excuse me, this is not something that judges themselves feel real glamorous and are just want to sort of move it past their docket for the day. So Representative Hillstrom's bill basically just says that it puts this particular misdemeanor on the uniform fine schedule, and we are hoping that people, instead of going before the judge, which they still have the right to do, that they pay the fine, which is in state law now at not less than $300, so we made it $300, and that we are hoping that both the moving violation and the fine start to get the word around Minneapolis, St. Paul, rural parts of Minnesota. This is a serious crime, and you shouldn't be passing a yellow school bus with the red lights on. And that's the fast version.
Thanks, Chair. Representative Hillstrom, I just saw we had a question from Representative Paymar.
Well, I'll wait until the testimony is done.
Certainly. So, members, originally when the school bus drivers came to me, they wanted me to interfere with the ability for the prosecutor to waive these kinds of agreements so that they could have additional convictions. I was not willing to do that. So then we met with some other folks to say, you know, what are our other options? And this was one option that came up, and the school bus drivers, of course, would like to have additional convictions. This would then make it not a mandatory court appearance. Now, if law enforcement wanted to still make this a mandatory court appearance, they could check the box if life or property were threatened. Now, if children are out and life or property are threatened, it is already a gross misdemeanor. So this is just something that this body should really talk about and decide. I mean, this is children on school buses and people passing through that school bus stop arm, I think, is a serious issue, and I think it warranted discussion of this committee about what the right decision is and how do we best get that to stop. So
thank you. And Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I met with Mr. Kelleher about the bill, and I expressed my concerns about it at the time. So I don't know if this has really improved anything. I guess, you know, like, if there's a problem with the courts not taking this seriously, that's one thing. Well, you're shaking your head no, Representative Hillstrom. I'm trying to understand the intent here. If the to put it on the payables list is saying, you know, it's a serious crime, but you can decide to go to court and plead your case, or you can just pay the ticket. Seems to me that we're minimizing the offense, and I heard the counter argument saying that because the courts aren't taking it seriously, you know, so let's avoid that step and just put it on the payables list. Am I reading that wrong?
Oh, Representative Paymar, while Mr. Keller may have said that, I don't believe that the courts don't take it seriously. These are mostly done through plea agreements, and they end up as continuances for dismissal based on the prosecutor's discretion. They would like some additional convictions. This is one way that they can get that. Now, Representative Paymar, I was not willing to interfere with the ability for prosecutors to plea bargain, and I was not willing to interfere with the defendant's ability to have their day in court. If they would like to come to court on the issue, I believe that they should have the ability to do that as well.
Okay, let me just...
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I'll just... Representative Hillstrom, you know, I know you're a new prosecutor, and so I'm curious to hear your perceptions of this, because in my former life, I used to spend a lot of time in court, not as an attorney, but I spent a lot of time in court. And I know that when people are forced to go to court, whether it's a plea agreement or not, it has an impact on them. That's my personal perception. So I'm just wondering if granting this kind of latitude takes that sort of accountability step out of it and just makes it sort of easier, like writing a check out on your parking ticket, as opposed to having to go through the inconvenience and frustration, humiliation, whatever it is, and go down to the courthouse and deal with this. Because I think this is really a serious issue. It's a serious safety issue. And just like a lot of the debate we've had in this body, your committee and my committee, on what should or shouldn't be on the payable list, to me it's sending, I know that's not the intent of Mr. Kelleher or the school bus drivers, but to me it's sending out sort of a message that you can violate the stop arm law and simply pay a ticket. And I know that's not the intent, but that's the way it seems to me, and I said that to Mr. Kelleher. And I also know this is a, when I was working my way through college, I used to drive a school bus, and I know how many people drive through them, and my heart would stop. I just would see somebody coming through my back mirror, and I think, my God, this little kid's going to get nailed. And it never happened during my experience. So that's my concern about what we're doing here. I just leave it at that, I guess, for now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
I guess I would want a response, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Paymer, in order to solve a problem, you have to have a bill. And so we put in a bill so that we would have the opportunity to discuss this as a committee to figure out what it is that the right thing to do is. I think they identified a really serious issue that I think we need to address. And the question is, how do we best do that as a committee? So it is my intention to lay this bill over for further discussion, but I wanted to make sure that all of you had the opportunity to hear this so that it could meet policy deadline if we decide we want to take on this issue this year and solve this problem. I am not certain what the other solution is, Representative Paymer. If I had it, it would have been written in the bill. So,
thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom. A couple of things here. I'm just wondering, did you happen to talk to the prosecutors to see why the lack of convictions or why all the plea deals on these?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, we had everybody in the room, and we were brainstorming about what some of our options might be. And it depends on what your goal is. If you have the goal that you want folks to come to court and have that accountability piece and appear in front of the judge and say this is a serious matter, then you do get a lot more plea negotiations. If the goal is to have the convictions and have it count as a moving violation, then you'll get more of those if people have the ability to pay the ticket. So ultimately, you have to decide what the goal is here. And when it was brought to me, the goal was to get additional convictions on this type of offense and to start having it affect the driving record.
Representative Johnson.
Just a couple comments. I've worked on numerous stop arm violation reports, and I would have to say of the reports we get, 80%+ of them are we can't do anything with. The bus drivers are giving us poor information, poor detail, and don't even give us the complete license plate or the wrong license plate. It gets us in a position where there's nothing we can do on these while we're investigating these incidents. That might be a problem where you're getting the reports, but you're not seeing the convictions. We're also not getting statements from the bus drivers. State Patrol has a form that they provide this bus drivers. It has some good information, but we also need a statement from them, which we never receive. I've had three cases myself where I had the court appearance. The bus driver, who's the main witness, never appeared in court. Those were thrown out. So it's not so much that we're not trying to get the convictions. It's other issues dealing with it that caused the issue that's not coming forward.
Representative Johnson, we did look at that, and we actually got some data about how many tickets were actually written. And there was a significant number of tickets that were actually written. And so one of the solutions that the bus company came with actually was putting photocop on the stop arm of the bus, and I don't support photocop, so you can imagine that wasn't one of the areas I wanted to go. Really, this is an opportunity for us to figure out what it is that we can do, because I think we all believe that our children need to be safe, and when the stop arm is out, people should stop. So we were told that there were actually 1,346 filings in 2011. Those were actual tickets that were issued. So considering there were 200-ish convictions, was that in 2012? 200?
I think there were both 11.
So that was in 2011. 1,346 tickets were issued and 200, a little more than 200 were got convictions. And so I understand that they have some concern here. And I just think that it was worthy of us having that discussion.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom, you know my history of concerns with the payables list. I'm wondering, was your motivation to draft the bill this way, directing the court to the Judicial Council to put this on the payables list, motivated by a desire to maintain the status of the crime as a misdemeanor, and yet also ensure that there are convictions? Because alternatively, when you're effectively making it a petty misdemeanor, we could just make it a petty misdemeanor in statute.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Paymer, by the nature of the way it is sentenced, if there is no jail stayed, then it becomes a petty misdemeanor by operation of law anyways. So Representative Lesh, it was drafted this way because I consulted with the court and said, look, we don't usually tell you what to put on the payables list. How would I go about doing that in an appropriate way?
Okay. Well, you know that I have issue with the courts just deciding what's a crime in the state of Minnesota because that's our job here. So I cringe when I see something directed to be placed on the payables list and would far prefer, if we're making something a petty misdemeanor, that it just be a petty misdemeanor. That said, if you make it a petty misdemeanor, now a person is still, of course, entitled to court as a petty misdemeanor. They're entitled to a full vetting and having their say. It's just that it's not in front of a jury. So if you wanted to preserve the right to trial by jury, you operated correctly. However, if you're looking for convictions, as you stated, it's alternative philosophy here, then we just make it a petty misdemeanor. That said, I don't know if there's anyone else at the table that's actually prosecuted these things, but I've prosecuted multiple, and I haven't heard from Mr. Kelleher on this. I don't think you've come to talk to me. Have you, Mr. Kelleher, on this?
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I did not. I talked to Representative Hillstrom outside the floor, and I was made aware that you have some concerns about putting things on the payable list, and then I think she had a chat with you about that.
Okay.
Well,
Mr. Kelleher, I mean, I prosecuted a lot of these. When I draw the short straw and have to go up and do petty traffic court, but I can tell you over 50% of the ones I end up having to deal on are because the school bus driver, who is our critical witness, does not show up. That's the bottom line. And that may not be the case in all jurisdictions, but that is the case in my jurisdiction. In the case of a defendant, if you don't show up for court, we put out a warrant, or we strike and certify it to your record. In the case of a witness who doesn't show up, we can't do anything. So that is one of the problems. I don't know if there's a way to get around that or to deal with it, but that may account for some of the drop-off in actual successful prosecutions that you're finding.
Mr. Kelleher?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, just a couple things. And while I have the opportunity, I did not mean to speak for the judges, Mr. Paymar, Representative Paymar, or clarify or try to state how they feel one way or the other about this proposed legislation. And to Representative Johnson, real fast, we are working on and have a set of forms that we have our drivers now fill out that help, that we've worked with local police departments about what is the proper information that's to be provided in regards to making an accusation that someone has violated the stop arm law. It's still up to law enforcement to investigate. And Representative Lesh, I think one of the things that we would still and are keeping this in this proposal as a misdemeanor, because one of the things that we feel would be effective is how this would affect people's driver's licenses. If people's driver's licenses become to be vulnerable or at risk because of this moving violation or, 15 miles an hour over the speeding limit, then their license gets limited for a certain period of time. And we feel that that's in itself a trigger point for most drivers, that as everybody knows, their driver's licenses nowadays are very, very vital. And we're thinking that that might show the seriousness of this crime violation.
Thank you. We do have another question from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of my questions was going to be, the Judicial Council, are they okay with this? And they said, go ahead.
Representative Scott, I talked to them about how it would be done technically. I didn't ask them if they were okay with me doing it.
Okay.
If they were okay with me doing it.
Okay.
And this is just going to be laid over and for us to talk about further.
Madam Chair, I have a hypothetical. And that's
if
my son or daughter is driving my vehicle and the vehicle goes around, if the car is titled to me and licensed to me, how do they, maybe this is more Representative Lesh, or maybe you can answer too, but how do they determine who was driving when? And, I mean, if the bus driver didn't actually see the driver and that scenario.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Representative Scott. That's always one of the challenges, and there are two parts, I believe, in the statute. One is if you're the owner of the vehicle, and one if you're the driver of the vehicle.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, I am really just looking for a point of clarification. I understand that the purview of this committee is to determine if, in fact, this would become law, what the consequence is of this action. What I'm wondering about is who would determine, you know, what sort of training, heightened awareness would the community be given to, yes, in fact, this is a violation, this is serious, you know, just some sort of training that this is not okay. I mean, clearly residents have been doing this repeatedly without having received fines, so I'm concerned that there's a lack of clarity about, you know, how serious this is.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pugh, currently, if you're issued a citation, you actually have to appear in court. So it is currently illegal. This just takes away the mandatory court appearance. We did meet with the stakeholders, and they are now having some discussion about what kinds of training they can do and how they can work together to improve the situation. So they're working on it.
Representative Drazkowski is next on the list, but Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I could yield to Representative Lesh. She's got
Representative Lesh.
Well, I'm just wondering, in light of Mr. Keller, did you consult with Driver and Vehicle Services to ensure that, despite the fact that we maintain this as a misdemeanor, regular misdemeanor in statute, but place it on the payables list, that it still qualifies for the civil license consequences that you're presuming that it will have? Because by operation of law, if you pay less than or $300 or less under statute, it is, by operation of law, a petty misdemeanor. However, are you certain that the license consequences remain the same if we maintain it as a regular misdemeanor in statute?
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I personally did not talk to Driver and Vehicle Services. As the school bus contractors, we have other issues with Drivers and Vehicle Services, mostly in regards to transference of titles and licenses and commercial driver's licenses and those sorts of things. I think one of the things that I'm trying to express to the committee, and I think we're partway there, is to discuss whether or not this is a problem that needs a solution. I am looking for, and Representative Hillstrom was very helpful in coming up with one solution. What we're looking for is for the public to be very overly aware that violating the stop arm in a school bus is really a wrong idea. It's unsafe for students. I had some solutions, but I think that they were a little draconian for some other people. I know that we met with the chiefs of police, and we are going to start there is a school bus safety awareness week every year. And we're going to do some publicity with the chiefs of police as well, besides trying to do this solution here in the legislature.
And members, we do have this. We are just laying this bill over, and we do have another bill that we need to hear as well.
And thank you, Mr. Keller, for that too. There is, I think, broad confusion. People will see yellow flashers on a school bus with no sign out, and they'll think they have to stop. So a lot of people are nervous, and they're not sure what to do. But I think you're correct. There is not a clear understanding on the part of the public about what needs to happen and when it needs to happen. And then some people see folks going around the bus when lights are yellow, and they think, oh, I can go around the bus with lights on, and then the lights are red and the sign's out, and they think, oh, yeah, well, I went around last time, I can go around this time, and it's just not the case. So thank you for raising the issue, and to Representative Hillstrom for having a discussion.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Hillstrom, as your bill works, if somebody was cited, they would have the ability to just pay the fine as a payable if they are self-admittedly guilty at that point. If they wanted to contest it in court, they still could. And if the police officer wanted to check the endangerment box, they would still be required to go to court and appear before a judge.
Representative Hillstrom.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. One question quick, Madam Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Representative Hillstrom, what about the separation of powers issue in here? Can you elaborate on that? You know this probably better than I or Representative Paymar or Lesher or somebody. Is there an issue here in that regard?
Representative Hillstrom.
I'm not a constitutional lawyer. The court puts stuff on the payables list that we don't. And so this will be my first attempt to put something on the payables list. Representative Druskowski.
Representative Lesh.
I squawk about the constitutional separation of powers of this payables list all the time, Representative Druskowski. But in the case where the legislature directs the court to set a certain designation for a crime or a crime schedule, I don't think there's a separation of powers issue. For my problem with separation of powers issue has to do when the court does it of their own volition. When the court sets prospective criminal policy unilaterally of their own accord, and this bill does not fit that criteria.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from members? Representative Hillstrom, then your bill, House File 1396, is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one last bill. That's House File 1398. Nope, we already heard that one.
1399.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd ask that we lay over 1399 for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Policy and Finance Bill. Madam Chair, what this does is it really starts to look at the conciliation court fee that we currently pay. Members, many of you know that we in the legislature over the last few years have been increasing the amount of amounts in controversy that can be taken care of in conciliation court. And it's much different work if you have a low-level amount versus a higher-level amount that's in controversy in terms of the amount of time that it takes for the judge to take care of these issues. And as I was working with the court on some other court fees, I learned that many courts across the country have staggered fees based on the amount in controversy. By operation of law already, the amount of conciliation court that can be done there, it currently is $10,000 and it's going up to $15,000. That's already in statute, and so I thought that it was appropriate for us to consider a staggered fee level as well for conciliation court. Being able to keep the amount for conciliation court of amounts between $0 and $5,000 lower, doing between $5,000 and $10,000 as high, a higher filing fee, and then as we increase the amount of the conciliation court up to $15,000, that we actually raise that fee for those amounts. And so this is a matter of policy for us to consider, and that's all.
Thank you, Representative Paymar.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, so obviously you have blanks here, but do you have a sense of what you might want to put in there and how much that this, that's my first question, and how much this would raise?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymar, absolutely. At this point, I don't know because I don't know what my budget target is. And ultimately, my goal is to get the amount of money that I need to fully fund the judiciary. And if I don't get it, this is one of the areas that I thought I might go to. We have requested the amount of that would be raised in each fee area. And I actually have a spreadsheet that I'm going to be giving to every member of the committee about each and every fee. I just don't know yet how many amounts in controversy are going to be between that new amount, between $10,000 and $15,000. But I believe in the old fiscal note, when we talked about raising that amount, I believe they identified a certain number of cases that they thought would increase and go. So that's what we'll be looking at, Representative Paymar.
So, Madam Chair, just to, you know, I know this committee is going to have a lot of work to do. You're correct, depending on what your target is. But as someone who has gone along with raising fees with you and others on this
over the years,
when we've needed to, I just want to say that, and we'll have to go through this process, that I'm not sure how many more fees we can raise. I mean, I appreciate your innovation and your thinking big picture here to try to raise more money for the courts. But, you know, there comes a time when we just can't raise these fees anymore and still provide justice to people, especially to poor people who are going to be affected by this bill. And so that's all I'll say about that, but I will have an interesting discussion at some point.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Paymer, I hope that I get a big enough target that I don't have to raise one fee.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, just one question. The origination of these fees to begin with, I expect they were probably put in place to cover the cost of the court, or at least offset a portion of the court for that time spent in conciliation court. To structure it this way, I would wonder, does it cost more in court costs for a $10,000 judgment than it does a $5,000 judgment? And if so, does that violate that whole precept to begin with? Anyway, just some thoughts.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski. I'm actually hearing that it does take a lot more work on behalf of the court when you're dealing with a larger amount in controversy. Cases that go to trial end up taking longer, typically have more information to deal with. And so, in fact, that's what I'm hearing, Representative Drazkowski.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, so can the courts provide that for us?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski. I'll see if I can get a couple of judges to come and talk about that, but most of the conversations I have been hearing have been related to some folks who've been concerned about us getting ready to go up to that $15,000, and there's been discussion about whether or not we should. And I'm not prepared to revisit that issue. This legislature already made that decision. So if the decision has already been made that we're going up to the higher amount, I just thought maybe we should consider what some other states do in terms of graduated fee based on amount and controversy.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would expect the court administrator should have that information and should be able to sort it rather readily based on the amount of the judgment. Might help us in decision-making, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Representative Drazkowski.
Well, and Representative Drazkowski, I would say that I worked as a law clerk after law school, and I don't think these fees really come anywhere close to covering the costs of the court. Conciliation court is extremely time-consuming. The parties aren't represented by an attorney. If you hire an attorney, you actually have to pay a higher filing fee to the court, even though sometimes your case moves quicker because you have an attorney representing you that knows what they're doing in the courtroom. So, I think that considering how costly conciliation court can be to the court system, I think it's a fair proposal to ask people who are going to choose that route to pay a little higher filing fee. It's from my opinion. Any other questions from members? If not, then House File 1399 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, we have to come back immediately following session. We heard Representative Winkler's bill yesterday, and so we need to come back for 5 minutes to pass that bill out. There will be no additional testimony. We will just actually have it in our possession. We'll adopt an amendment. We'll be sending it on to the next committee.
Thank you. And can I get a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Lesh moves to approve the minutes from March 12th. Any corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 All those opposed? Motion prevails. And members, we are recessed until after session tonight.